Welcome to On the Brink Radio, broadcast number 211. This is Jeff Weverson coming at you from the base of Uluru, one of the most sacred power spots in all of Australia and all of the world. It's the Red Rock in the center of Australia. We left Darwin a few days ago and have driven down here, stopping at a few beautiful places, and I'm now standing all about 100 meters from the base of the rock herself, doing the base walk in a counterclockwise direction. It's very beautiful and powerful. There's a good bit of cloud, which is really the first amount of cloud I've seen of any significance since Magnetic Island about 2.5 months ago. There's almost a constant presence in the air of helicopters and or planes. You can probably hear some right now, but sending very, very beautiful, powerful healing blessings here during this very sacred window of time. Around the 8th of August is what the metaphysical esotericists refer to as the Lion's Gate. It has to do with the heliacal rising of Sirius. And some friends of mine are actually at the Sphinx and the Great Pyramid right now. And it's very interesting to me that the dates of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, August 6th and 9th, which are just in the past few days, happens to coincide precisely with the Lion's Gate or the heliacal rising of Sirius. So I wonder if there's some kind of ancient New World Order cult of death connection with the dark Egyptian legacy. Who knows, something to think about, but I'm here to really experience the beauty and power of Mother Earth in a beautiful, sacred place, fully honoring the men's and women's sacred sites and all the ancient cosmological dreamtime song lines and dreaming locations and stories with utmost respect. But ultimately, my goal here, as well as with all of my travels down under and really my whole life, has been increasingly to connect directly the energy and power of Mother Earth herself, and secondarily with the people stuff, regardless of who they are or when they were here. As I walk around Uluru, I will try to share thoughts and impressions that come into my mind. I'm asking to be of service to Mother Uluru in any way that I can. I talked with Barbara Randall on the phone today, the widow of Uncle Bob Randall, who used to be one of the custodians of Uluru. She gave us permission to go to the Mutajulu waterhole, which I'll go to in another couple hours. But I'm asking from Uluru to give me power and wisdom and inspiration to do all of my work here in this lifetime. The healing of Koyaanisqatsi. I'm here at Katajuta at Valley of the Winds. It's the day after I was at Uluru. Very amazing, powerful time here. At Uluru, I met a beautiful Pitjantjatjara artist named Pamela Taylor. She was painting a very interesting painting of Orion and the Pleiades. Very, very cool. I'm going to send her a painted rock. And I also was able to meet and catch up with Keisha Randall, Uncle Bob's favorite granddaughter. This is a very interesting connection. These are the traditional people of this land. We're now at Katajuta, also called the Olgas by the white man, doing a walk called Valley of the Winds before we head back to Alice. Very beautiful and cosmic place. Very peaceful energy here. Beautiful, warm winter day. It's now several days later, after I was recording at the base of Uluru and Katajuta. I've been at Alice Springs for about 6 days, lingering in the beautiful warm sunshine after being in the tropical warmth for over 4.5 months, and preparing to head south down into Adelaide into a much more southerly region that's probably going to be cloudy and rainy and cold. But onward I must go. Right now, I'm sitting in the Todd River, as so many rivers are in Australia. It's not actually a river except for a few weeks or months during the wet season when it's raining. Now it's just a giant river of sand. And it's a place that's been notorious over the recent history of Alice Springs. It's a place where all the local indigenous people would come and get drunk at night and build fires and camp out and have rubbish and stuff like that. It was very much like that the last time I was here several years ago. Now it seems a lot more kind of cleaned up a group of indigenous people did just sort of come out about several hundred meters from me to the south, and they're all sitting down beneath some trees, but I don't see any. There's some rubbish, but I don't see any sort of riffraff or anything. When it starts to get dark here on the streets of Alice, it does seem like that. It starts to get a little more kind of surreal in terms of the people coming out of the cracks and stuff like that. But to be honest, I never really liked this town. I always thought it had a kind of a coarse, rough feel to it, even a good bit of sort of racism, which I think is probably still there. But now it seems like a lot of the black people I see on the street have a more sort of coarser vibe than they had before. I don't know, this is just my impression. I haven't really been in the town itself except for the past couple of days staying at a backpacker. I thought it would be fairly legendary to record part of a shove from sitting in the Todd River itself. Anybody who's been here will know what I'm talking about. But this show is really about contrasting the, what I call the indigenous perspective, the indigenous consciousness, the indigenous mentality, the indigenous relationship with our fellow beings and Mother Earth, as opposed to the civilized relationship between each other and fellow beings and Mother Earth. The show is called Message from the Red Center in the Presence of the Sacred. In my email posting from last week's show, called The Atlantean Discontinuity in the Absence of the Sacred and the Healing of Koyaanisqatsi, I contrasted the beauty and harmony of Uluru, the big red sandstone monolith in the center of Australia, an icon of Dreamtime, a symbol of the indigenous harmony of the natural world. I contrast the image of Uluru with that of, say, like the Great Pyramid and the Sphinx, for example, or other feats of ancient geoengineering that were based on mining precious things from the land, on war with nature, on the engineering and mechanization that we continue to glorify ourselves for our progress so far down the path of. So it's very interesting to think of Uluru sitting here in the central desert of Australia for hundreds of millions of years at least, and the pyramid sitting there in Egypt for maybe a few tens of thousands of years at most. And so why does our mentality, the distributed mental operating environment of today, why do we glorify the pyramids and even think that they had to be done by an advanced civilization of extraterrestrial stonemasons? Why do we worship that and a beautiful, sacred, natural place like Uluru is basically invisible? I mean, sure, it's a well-known tourist destination, but beyond that, did you ever see any documentary films or books about the geological history of Uluru? One of the things I'd like to try to do on this show is to contrast my speculations and intuitions about the mentality of the Dreamtime, the mentality of the indigenous people of Australia, for example, way back in the day before the invasion of the white man, and how this is, to me, probably very similar to a state of grace that beings in the Garden of Eden might have had. This is all using mythological metaphors, of course, but the sort of mentality of the, what you might call the Sat Yuga, S-A-T, Sat Yuga meaning truth. It means the golden age in the ancient calendrical system of the Hindus. This mentality is contrasted with the very distorted and demented distributed mental operating environment of today that I've observed on and warned about and had to deal with every day. A mentality that irrevocably anthropocentric. Its anthropocentrism permeates the entire distributed mental operating environment. And so, if our mentality remains fixed within and on ourselves, what possibility do we have of actually even making a rudimentary step towards a genuine understanding of beings that aren't human, beings that aren't even animals, like plants, trees, rocks, planets, Mother Earth, comets, asteroids, stars, galaxies? All these are beings that live in the same universe that we're in. But we've come to think that we're the only intelligence in the universe, and that everything else may or may not have wee little gradations of intelligence based on our own ability to quantify and detect these signs of intelligence in all these other beings and life forms. It's actually quite bizarre. I think that the ancient indigenous mentality of the Australian people was very much like what the mentality of the whales and dolphins of today is like, or especially if they were living in a world undisrupted by military-industrial activities. Even though the indigenous people of Australia have hands and do use tools, they're still essentially a non-material, spiritually oriented culture. Whereas the whales and dolphins don't even have hands. They don't have objects that they manipulate. They don't have symbolic language. These are things I've talked about on the show many, many, many times. But they both have all the salient qualities of very, very sophisticated spiritual cosmology. Well, it's now tomorrow, which is Thursday. It's the day after yesterday and the day before tomorrow. It's tomorrow from when I last recorded here in the Todd River for On the Brink Radio. I'm back in the Todd River again here in Alice Springs, Northern Territory, continuing my show called Message from the Red Center in the Presence of the Sacred. Only critically thinking and inwardly directed minds have any hope of mapping the distributed mental operating environment of today. It's kind of like a fish trying to understand water. It's not impossible, but requires a great degree of detachment. So, in a way, that's kind of what I'm trying to do with this show and with a lot of my shows. Our psychic landscape is quite varied, but trends and similarities do exist. For example, that's the nature of what psychologists and psychoanalysts would call archetypes, sort of shared features of our collective consciousness and or unconsciousness, our collective psyche that is shared or common to all of humanity, more or less, which would mainly be features and aspects of nature. For example, archetypes of the sun, the moon, the stars, water, clouds, rain, trees, rivers, animals of different kinds, celestial events, comets, asteroids, thunder, lightning, earthquakes, volcanoes, all of these things, stones, vegetables, fruits, nuts, all of these things are archetypes of our mind, because they're as ancient as any contents of our psyche could be. In the world of today, in the world of industrial civilization, or of civilization in general, we've got more modern, I guess you could still call them archetypes, although the archa on there tends to basically mean that it's really old, like archaic or archaeology, archaeopteryx. But modern archetypes, which that's almost an oxymoron, but trends or symbols or images or artifacts of our modern day psyche that are shared by many people in the world of today would be more sort of products like the worldview espoused by television or mass media, Hollywood, the products, automobiles, guns, chainsaws, tractors, mobile phones, selfie sticks. All of these are sort of features littering the psychic landscape of today. And I've often thought that the expression consensus reality is almost an oxymoron too, as is, for example, livable city. But I think that, you know, in keeping with my earlier part of the show and contrasting the qualitative dimensions of indigenous consciousness versus the quote-unquote consciousness of civilized humanity, that what binds people today and forms more of a consensus reality than anything having to do with nature is probably the central most connecting factor of other than that we all are subjected to gravity and breathe oxygen, is that everybody kind of implicitly worships this false Moloch of human creation called money. But the point I'm getting at is that people of today in every society, whether they think of themselves as indigenous or civilized or whatever, are largely products of the engineering of consumer society. They're sort of consumer clones, mentally and increasingly physically. Because, you know, like in the world of today, no matter what country you go to, everybody's going to be driving almost the same cars, they're going to be talking on almost the same mobile phones, they're going to be watching the same shows on television, watching the same shows on television, regardless of what language it might be, and they still might be watching I Love Lucy in a different language, but it's all the same thing. So a lot of this is subject for another show. I don't want to deviate too far from what I was talking about, but I've realized that a really important distinction to make, or a parallel to look at, is what I might call intra-species contamination through communication. That would be different countries or cultures, language groups, within humanity itself, which is, or used to be, just one species of life, how different language groups and cultures can contaminate others through the process of communication. Now, it might be more accurate to say that through communication, a cross-pollination occurs, whereas through invasion, a contamination occurs. That's probably closer to the truth, but there's elements of both. But it's really important to think about when you're trying to understand what the expression indigenous means in the world of today. Are there truly any indigenous people left, of human indigenous people? I'm not sure that there are. There might be tribes of people living in remote places that have yet to be discovered by the outside world, but those would be the only ones that could truly qualify as indigenous, the ones that had not yet been discovered or looked upon, gazed upon, recorded, or photographed by David Attenborough, the BBC, or any other news gathering, research, anthropologists, organizations, or anything like that, if you see what I mean. In addition to intraspecies contamination through communication, we have the looming possibility, although I think it's highly unlikely, the looming possibility of interspecies contamination through communication. This is what would happen. Like, if you see what's happened when the indigenous people of almost every continent and country have been contacted by civilized man and then had their, been invaded, and they've learned the language and been forced to take on all the customs and had the living shit beat out of them for speaking their own language and gotten all these diseases and killed for their gold and just the age-old story. Why would anyone think that if the supposed, in very large quotation marks, the supposed communication barrier between humans and cetaceans was ever breached, that if whales and dolphins could speak to us in English, people go like, oh, they'll tell us all kind of cool stuff. And I go like, no, all they're going to do is suffer from having their minds infected by all of our bullshit. But see, that's why it's never going to happen. We're too stupid when it comes to trying to understand what communication really is. I'm using language now, but I understand its limitations very well. I like to do nonverbal talk radio. But the whales and dolphins are, I believe, deliberately protecting themselves and or being protected by a sort of psychic and cognitive membrane that's preventing any kind of actual communication happening in terms of the way that we think that we want it to happen. Like people that think that it's all this left hemisphere, sort of like linear, mechanistic, reductionistic belief system based on symbolic language. We think that we're going to crack their code and decipher the signals in their clicks and whistles and we're going to translate their language into English. And see, but that, again, there's so much bull. It's riddled with just as many Swiss cheese holes as climate change. If you talk about dolphin language, A, that's incorrect because language implies using your tongue to speak, and they don't do that. And B, how many human languages are there? Thousands. So why would there just be one dolphin language that we'd crack? And, or why would there be one cetacean language? There'd be many, many, many different ones, many different dialects. Again, this is an example of what I touched on earlier in the show, is that anthropomorphism and anthropocentrism is just permeates every nook and cranny of our psyche and everything we try to do. And it's the anthropocentrism is invisible to us. We can't even see it. Anthropocentrism is to the human mentality as water is to a fish, or in New Zealand, a fush. We can't see the forest because we're too busy counting and chopping down the trees. I think that when you look at symbols and the related concept of maps, it's so powerful of a cognitive mutagen. Like, we tend to look at the evolution of symbolic language as an asset, as a force multiplier of our intelligence coefficient that's enabled us to conquer space and time and each other. And in a way, that's true, especially if your belief system of values is only anthropocentric. If we're just looking at the survival and supposed short-term well-being of our own species, sure, symbolic language has helped us to accelerate our learning curve, our expenditure of the Earth's and the heliocosm store of energy that's been the ladder we've climbed to reach the position of the dominant species on this planet. But it's really symbolic language and communication has really been a cognitive mutagen in that it's enabled us to truly mutate our own psyche in ways that we can't even understand. And even it led a kind of psychedelic author and researcher and pharmaceutical chemonaut William S. Burroughs to declare, and I believe he even wrote about it somewhere, that he thought that language was a virus. But if you think about it, there's some interesting ideas in there, because a virus, as we understand it or have created it in our mind, a virus consists of information at the genetic level, basically RNA and DNA, nucleic acids that are information codes that tell the cellular structures and processes of an organism that it invades. It's information that tells the cell, the host cell, what to do. The virus on its own can't do anything. It's just some information. But once it gets in the right place where it can take over, just like the CIA putting in their people as the heads of corporations and government organizations and military departments and stuff like that. It's like a virus is in a position to take command of the organism through control of its central command, control and communication channels. Another interesting topic for another show. So there's two things that I'm trying to address here. Imagining the undisrupted dream time, which would be sort of like trying to enter the Garden of Eden in your mind. And I think that that's what the sculptures of William Ricketts and the Dandenongs of Melbourne and at Pitchy Ritchie here in Alice Springs, his sculptures of the indigenous people here, what they were like, what they looked like, you know, 70 years ago, before they were almost totally prevented from living in their ancient way. They look like angels from the Garden of Eden. And I believe that this form of mentality, this distributed mental operating environment, was very closely isomorphic with and resonant with nature herself, the universe. And even philosophers have written at length about the mind as nature. I think Gregory Bateson even wrote a book called that, The Mind as Nature, because when you think about it, traditionally, like until the dawn of civilization, like probably for millions of years before we had civilization, before we lived in cities, before we had houses and electricity and lights and noise and all that stuff, before then, our minds would have been nature. And our minds would have had smaller components of that which we created, which is in truth a part of nature, but we would have had stories and songs and beliefs and stuff, but we wouldn't have had massive walls of voodoo artifacts that substituted themselves for the truly alive contents of nature. So imagining the undisrupted dream time, which I think is what the consciousness of the Sat Yuga is like, the golden age. It's the longest age in the Hindu cycle of the galactic seasons. It's the age in which we are our truly spiritual selves. And that's how I think that the indigenous people of Australia have always been until the white man came. And I think that that's how the whales and dolphins are now, even though they aren't suffering per se from all of the same things that have befallen the indigenous people. They haven't been forced to stop speaking their language. They haven't had their children stolen to go to a Catholic school. They haven't had alcohol and tobacco and white flour and sugar foisted on them. They haven't been forced to engage in slave labor or to copulate with and bear children with the white man. The whales and dolphins have avoided all this. Not to say that they aren't suffering immensely from human industrial, military industrial civilization, which they are. But the parallels are very severe and very salient here. Another thing to think about are the mechanisms of assimilation. You know, I just touched on some of those. But if you look at, for example, the plight of the indigenous people of Australia, like here in the central desert where I am right now, you know, you see a lot of these people on the street, and it just makes your heart break. And many of them are very destitute, It's just an extremely complex situation. I mean, I could record probably 3 whole radio shows just talking about the indigenous situation here in Australia. I've touched on it many, many times. But this visit to Australia has been very, very, very enlightening in that way, and into the utter complexity and contradictions within this whole scenario. And this bears heavily on, you know, trying to determine what it does mean to be indigenous. Because I think that it's probably accurate to say that there's truly no real indigenous people left in this world, unless they haven't been discovered by the white man yet, or the European Western civilization of humans. People can be the cetaceans too. Civilization is like this giant invasive juggernaut. You see how it's moved in here in Australia just in the past 150 years. And in an area where I now sit, or, you know, 500 meters from here, was probably a very sacred meeting ground, because it's the bed of a giant river, and at a sort of a central crossroads here at a gap in the McDonald Ranges that was a very sacred, probably a meeting ground of many different tribes. There was a lot, there's like probably 40 or 50 different language group communities. Well, these are communities formed by the white man in the past 100 years or so. So I'm not sure. There are a lot of indigenous people whose land this is, and they all lived relatively close to each other in varying degrees of harmony and possibly conflict, but they all lived together here for a really long time. The white man has come along and sort of rounded them all up into these communities and stuff, very similar to the way that they created all the reservation systems for the Native Americans in the States. But this show that I'm recording today has been more of sort of a list of topics that deserve greater in-depth coverage in future shows. But I'd just like to thank the Central Desert of Australia, the spirit of Uluru and Katajuta and Kings Canyon, and all the beautiful people I've met and are continuing to meet. I've been meeting a lot of people from Italy lately. A lot of people from France, all the nice people that are supporting my art. Looks like I'm going to be painting a mural for a backpacker here over the next few days. Then I'm going to continue south down to Adelaide and hopefully make a trip up to the Flinders Ranges to visit Wilpena Pound and possibly my old friend Uncle Ron Coulthard, who's been a very profound activist against uranium mining in that area. And then possibly make a trip down to Kangaroo Island, which I've never been to before. Then over to Melbourne, and then I've got a flight back to New Zealand on the 7th of September out of Sydney. So that's a lot of ground to cover. But this has been a very fantastic visit. I've spent a couple of months on Magnetic Island. I've recorded 5 shows at the Botanical Garden in Darwin, which I really again want to thank Gregor and Aquaria for having me, and my friends at Eva's Cafe in the Darwin Botanical Garden, and all my beautiful grandmother tree family there, everyone here in the Central Desert, everyone who I'll see on my journey, everyone who's supporting me, and also Teddy, Wally, Ruby Ann, Big Teddy, Heidi, and Phil. Oh, Webby-ups, we love you, and we've really been, well, we miss this the ocean, because this is the longest we've been away from the ocean in many, many months. Well, yeah, it's been 2 or 3 weeks since we got to swim in the ocean, that last day we left Darwin. I think maybe at Kallang in New South Wales we might have gone almost this long without seeing the ocean. But we'll be there soon enough. But anyway, this is Jeff Wefferson Phillips signing off from the Todd River Basin here in Alice Springs, Northern Territory, land of the Dreamtime ancestors. I'd like also to thank Aboriginal artist Harold Thomas, designer of the Aboriginal flag and landscape artist par excellence, for giving me permission from his stance as a traditional custodian of this land and a fellow artist, giving me permission to paint my interpretation of a rainbow serpent type being for this mural. And Harold, I really want to thank you for your ongoing work, and also Peter Chumley and all my beautiful friends. This is Jeff Wefferson signing out from On the Brink Radio. Take care, good day, and right, mate.
Thank you.